Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 16th of December 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. We've actually reached episode number 58. We've gone racing through the year discussing all the ways we can look at history through a patriotic lens. We've looked at Egypt, we've looked at the Indus Valley Civilization, we've looked at Mesopotamia, and we've spent a long time now looking at British history because, of course, myself and my co-hosts are all British. And on the mention of my co-hosts, I have Patriot here with us today from the Patriotic Arts Community, and we have Truefids from truefids.net. Patriot, how are you doing, sir? Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Sven. Thanks for having me back. I'm doing well, thanks.
Excellent, excellent. Truefids, how are you doing? Thank you for coming back to the show, and how's life treating you?
All good, Sven. Life's great. Looking forward to this.
Excellent, excellent. And we're going to get more into the Saxon point of view, really, I think, today, because we're going to be talking about St. Oswald, one of the first of the Saxon saints. In the last episode, we talked about how Cadwallo had come back from Ireland and he won 16 victories against the Saxons with his ally Pendar, pretty much wiping them all out between the Firth and the Humber, with the exception of one Christian Saxon king who was called Oswald. Oswald collected the relics of his kingdom and led his men in AD 635 against the remorseless Briton and his general Pendar at Heavenfield or Dennisbourne near Durham. Elevating the cross on an earthen mound, he and his army knelt around it and offered up a simple but fervent prayer that the God of battles would deliver them from the proud tyrant that had sworn the destruction of their race. The appeal was not in vain. Cadwallo and Pendar were defeated with heavy losses. Success was not, however, of long continuance. Oswald was defeated, slain, and his dead body crucified by Cadwallo at Maserfield, since then called Oswald's Tree, or Oswest Tree. Now, that's a bit of a bizarre thing for a Christian king to do. Cadwallo was a Christian king. And I think what they really meant by this is they hanged his body on the tree as a warning to the other Saxons. And I say this is rather important because back down in the south, once the Saxon kings had died, the Saxons there returned back to paganism. But here in the Midlands, where we had St. Oswald, who is now a saint, he was a Christian king. And this was the first of the Christian kings, I think, to really be sainted. Truefids, any thoughts on this or any other parts of the story or where we got to up till now?
Yeah, I was just going to say what you said, that it's surprisingly that he would have crucified, you know, a Christian would do that. But yeah, perhaps it's just hanging him from the tree as an example, right? But it's interesting that this guy turned to Christianity and he was able to actually win one or two victories, right? And I think that that also happened to the Danes, where they were seeing how well, you know, when you have a Christian army, how much better they care for each other, that they're actually stronger military than just a random pagan army. And it also has that effect that you realize that, hang on a minute, Christianity is better than just having a pagan society. It runs much better, you know, and especially military as well. You'll be more powerful because you all love each other and care for each other, right?
And you have a belief in a life after death as well. So, that, you know, they're not too frightened to die, which they had in common with the Druidic religion. That was something that Julius Caesar picked up on, that the Britons had no fear of death because they believed in an afterlife, which I'm not quite sure that the Romans did. And obviously the Christians believe in an afterlife. So that gives them, a lack of fear about death. And of course, we had all these marches that were martyred for their faith as well. They would rather die than renounce their faith, which, you know, set a huge example to the people around them. I think that if it wasn't for that, really, Christianity wouldn't have taken off. It was because these people were willing to die for their faith. That's what really cemented the faith in the other people's minds, I think. Patriot, any thoughts on where we've got to so far?
I'm just trying to better understand the the religions of both sides. Were they both representative of Christianity? Because as an Anglo-Saxon king, didn't he bring sort of Celtic Christianity to the region?
Well, he was an Anglo-Saxon king, so what he had was Augustinian Christianity, I think. Right. Although he could have been converted by Saint Columba or Saint Aidan, I'm not quite sure who he was converted by. But he was obviously fighting against Cadwallo, so his loyalty was to the Saxons. So it's likely he may have been converted by this Augustinian mission. But I mean, it is surprising because after Ethelfrith died and the other king died that were in the south in Kent, I think, and Wessex, both of them went back to paganism. But this king here, Oswald from this family of Oswald, we're also told he's from the family of Odin. He's from Odin's family. That's in his ancestry. But he was actually a Christian. So they elevated him. But Cadwallo was Christian as well. But he was from the Celtic Christianity. So, yeah, it could have been a clash between the two. Because don't forget also this army on the orders of Ethelfrith and Augustine also went up to Bangor and massacred all the monks at Bangor. This is why Cadwallo is so furious at the Saxons and has sworn to kill all of them, basically, because of what they did to the monks at Bangor.
Right. Yeah, so it's more of a revenge trip rather than a sort of a crusade in many ways I think it was just an act of vengeance, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, he swore to execute all the Saxons between the Firth and the Humber. And he won 16 victories, which apparently we have recorded by contemporary authors. And then he gets to Oswald and they get defeated by Oswald, but then they end up killing Oswald as well. So it was the first loss in the battle, but they eventually ended up killing Oswald. So if we have a look at what Wikipedia has to say about Saint Oswald, Oswald soon came to be regarded as a saint. Bede says that the spot where he died came to be associated with miracles, and people took dirt from the site, which led to a hole being dug as deep as a man's height. And I'll just stop there because that's because what they used to think was that the soil that was over a holy man had miraculous properties and it could heal people. And this, I think this went on right up until the 15th, 16th century, because it mentions it in the Douay Rheims Bible, in the sleeve notes of the original Douay Rheims, the one that was actually banned, not the one that you're able to get now, but the one that actually had sleeve notes. And it talks there about dirt from a grave. And this was really sort of what ideas of medicine were back then. It was all based on this belief in Christianity and that the soil from a grave could actually heal someone. And I think there is a story in the Old Testament, I think Elijah, I think his clothes that he was buried in the grave, I think they actually had miraculous properties, or the bones. And I think it goes back to that. I mean, Truford, do you know what I'm referring to there about Elijah or Elisha and his bones?
I'm not sure off the top of my head. No, I know that as a guy took over for Elijah and he performed even greater miracles, right? And there's the first raising of the dead there, you know, kind of a prequel to Christ coming. But I don't recall any relics or anything like that.
Yeah, I think that's the origin of the relic story. It was his clothes or his bones that had these miraculous properties. And I think then you hear of somebody trying to hold on to Jesus's cloak, because they think that's going to have miraculous properties as well in the New Testament. But yeah, that obviously led to this idea that the dirt above the grave of a holy man would have miraculous properties. Reginald of Durham recounts another miracle, saying that his right arm was taken by a bird, perhaps a raven, to an ash tree, which gave the tree ageless vigour. When the bird dropped the arm onto the ground, a spring emerged from the ground. Both the tree and the spring were, according to Reginald, subsequently associated with healing miracles. And that's an interesting one, because also when St. Nunn gave birth to St. David, a spring fell up, emerged out of the ground. There's also the story of St. Justinian, and where his head fell to the ground, a spring emerged from the ground, and this was holy. And if you actually go to Oswestry, they've got like a brass or a bronze sculpture of an eagle with St. Oswald's arm within it. And then underneath that, you've actually got the holy well where the spring of water actually came up. And it's got bars in front of it. We actually went to have a look at it with PA Wales. So it's still there where this happened, and this is where the name of the town Oswestry, which is in Shropshire, that's where it comes from, Oswald's tree. So you have this legend of him being stuck up on the tree. You also have a legend of his arm being taken by this bird. It says here perhaps a raven, but the bird that they have in this sculpture is of an eagle. It tells you up there on a plaque that it was an eagle, and the eagle dropped the arm, and a holy well came up out of the ground. Aspects of the legend have been considered to have pagan overtones or influences. This may represent a fusion of his status as a traditional Germanic warrior king with Christianity. The name of the site, Oswest Tree or Oswald's Tree, is generally thought to be derived from Oswald's death there and the legends surrounding it. His feast day is the 5th of August, and the cult surrounding him even gained prominence in parts of continental Europe, Oswald in Slovenia. So this made its way all the way around Europe. I mean, this was a very important king, I think, and he must have been a very good king to be sainted like this and to have all these miracles associated with him. Any thoughts on this, True Fitz?
Yeah, firstly, I would say I wouldn't encourage people to worship saints or relics, but of course there were miracles that God was performing because he wanted Christianity to spread, right? That's all I would say on that. Maybe these things did happen, but it was God trying to spread Christianity, right? As for the spread of the saint, it shows you how much people rever martyrs. You know, when people really dedicate their life and are willing to die for their beliefs, it resonates with people and inspires people, right? That's why we have all these heroes who become popular because they died for something, right?
Yeah, and I think also this idea with the holy wells, I think a lot of these wells were holy places beforehand. And then when Christianity came along, they just Christianized these places. Like we have churchyards that have stone circles around them, and we've got standing stones within churches. And I think originally these holy wells, they may have been sacred to the Druids, and then they became Christianized. And maybe this story of the well just springing up out of the ground, maybe that was associated previously with someone else to do with the site. And I think also these ideas and, there would be possibly some exaggerations there. But yeah, it was all about getting people to become Christian and saying these amazing things happened around these people, which shows that the faith that they were following is the correct faith, and which shows that Christianity is what you should be following. So there was an element of that with it as well. I do find it interesting that it's still there today, you know, like the well is still there, although it's dried up. It's got like a portcullis thing in front of it. There's rocks in front of it. It's a shame it hasn't been more well looked after. And there's this nice big bronze sculpture above it. I'll have to look up the photos again on the PA Wales site on Telegram. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, similar sentiments to what's been said already. I mean, I'm not doubting the miracles that God could perform, but I think there's probably a little bit of exaggeration there, and kind of tenets of truth, but just kind of elaborated somewhat to help encourage and instill a sense of faith and belief. And I think a lot of the time, it's the belief in these sort of symbols or symbolic acts which kind of manifest themselves through the belief. If that makes sense, it's the power comes from the belief that it instills in the people.
Yeah, I mean, that could be what was the source of the effect of these holy wells, because they really did believe that you could be healed by washing in the waters of a holy well. And I think that belief goes back centuries. And, you know, there are reports of that happening right up into the 1900s, people going to holy wells. I think Lourdes is one of those places with the holy springs where people get healed by washing in the water. I mean, it's a very, very long tradition that goes back millennia, that you could just wash in these waters and you would be healed. This is before we had all the medical technology that we have today. So as you say there, perhaps it was just this belief, and the belief was so strong that it was going to do that and mind over matter, and they would be healed by it. And also perhaps, you know, there was a genuine religious side to it, and just over the years that has now receded. because we have a belief in another thing and God works in other ways. But, you know, it could be elements of both in this, I think. Bede mentions that Oswald's brother Ossiu, who succeeded Oswald in Bernicia, retrieved Oswald's remains in the year after his death. In writing of one miracle associated with Oswald, Bede gives some indication of how Oswald was regarded in conquered lands. Years later, when his niece Osthryth moved his bones to Bardney Abbey in Lindsay, its inmates initially refused to accept them, although they knew him to be a holy man because he was originally of another province and had reigned over them as a foreign king, and thus they retained their ancient aversion to him, even after death. So there we have it. I mean, these are Christians that don't actually want his bones, because although he was a Christian, he was ruling over them, and he was from a different group. So maybe that explains, you know, why there was this trouble between Oswald, who was a Christian, and between Edwin, who was also a Christian. But it was only after Oswald's bones were the focus of an awe-inspiring miracle, in which during the night a pillar of light appeared over the wagon in which the bones were being carried and shone up into the sky, that they were accepted into the monastery. In the morning, the brethren, who had refused it the day before, began themselves earnestly to pray that those holy relics, so beloved by God, might be deposited among them. And it is interesting, you know, this sort of cult of the relics. I think a lot of it is just to sort of prove that this person existed. You know, we have these parts of his body. This person existed. Going all the way back to, these are the nails on the cross. This proves that Christ was crucified, or that this is a splinter from the actual cross. It's like having sort of evidence that can be put before people to prove that these people weren't just being made up. It wasn't just a fantasy. There was things that had been left behind by them. And I think a lot of these relics were lost, I think, during the Protestant Reformation. When a lot of the abbeys and places were smashed up, a lot of these relics were lost. But sometimes they would carry them in front of them in battle as well. And there were, as I say, there were miracles that were associated with them. Any thoughts on this and this miracle here, Treefids?
Yeah, it just shows you that that there was still some paganism in the Christianity, that they believed that, you know, you could carry people's relics and pray to the saints and rather than just God, right? So there was some good in regards to the Protestant Reformation, where they realized, look, we shouldn't be praying to these relics. Perhaps just destroying it all wasn't, you know, the best way to do it. They could just educate people, but you know it is what it is, right?
Yeah, it's a bit similar to, you know, Black Lives Matter wanting to destroy things, you know, instead of just saying, well, we think about things in a different way now. You know, there's no need to just destroy everything. That's like this ISIS mentality. And the Protestants did have a similar mentality. You know, they just destroyed so much of the ancient traditions and the heritage that we had. And a lot of the lands that the church owned were then transferred over to the lords. And E. Michael Jones refers to it as a looting operation in Britain, the Protestant Reformation, because we didn't have indulgences. We didn't have a lot of the injustices that were occurring on the continent that were associated with the Roman Catholic Church. We didn't actually have them in England. And Henry VIII just took advantage of the fact that there was this Protestant Reformation happening elsewhere. And he wanted to marry again. And he made himself the supreme governor of the church, basically. So instead of getting rid of, you know, having the Pope as the supreme, he basically said, well, look, we'll make the king the supreme governor of the church. So rather than reforming it in the way that he should do, they just did the same thing again, and sadly destroyed so much of our heritage. When you think of Glastonbury Abbey and that's left in ruins, and all these magnificent edifices that have been created were just smashed up, and there used to be all paintings on the inside as well, because they used to think, you know, well, you know, glory be to God. We need to create somewhere that's absolutely glorious to reflect how glorious the Creator is. And then you got the Protestants that wanted to destroy it. And a lot of the places where the relics were, the containers for them, they were really ornate as well. And I think there might be a part of St. David that's still actually at St. David's. as I say, you know, you shouldn't be praying to these things. But there was this idea that these relics did have miraculous properties, and they were also proof that the person existed. I think that was the most important thing. There were proof that the person existed back then, when you didn't have cameras, and you know, you didn't have access to the documents and the records that we have today. Patriarch, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's often the case that I see the same things with some Christians today. You know, when they start to touch on new revelations and doctrines, they really start to undo all the stitching, you know, and go through, sift through the scriptures, and then it's like the pendulum swings from one side to the other, and you know, they fail to realize the value that in what has been created, you know. And they just go on a kind of like an insane trip of trying to kind of correct doctrine, but completely go off the wall, you know. And I still see it today in people's, you know, when people have certain revelations, they'll just go completely the opposite way. And they just kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, that's the saying, isn't it? Throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I guess as man, we're corrupted as well. You know, we try to do our best, but no matter what we do, you know, we can't be perfect because we're not perfect. So you might have, you know, the right idea of trying to reform something, but when you go about doing it, it's not quite done in the way that it really should have been. Again, getting back to what Wikipedia has to say here, in the early 10th century, Bardney was in Viking territory, and in 909, following a combined West Saxon and Mercian raid led by Ethelfled, the daughter of Alfred the Great, St. Oswald's relics were translated to a new minster in Gloucester, which was renamed St. Oswald's Priory in his honour. Ethelfled and her husband Ethelred, the Ealdorman of Mercia, were buried in the priory, and their nephew King Ethelstan was a major patron of Oswald's cult. So we really had these sort of cults that were then building up around these Roman Catholic saints, which I don't think we had with the Celtic saints. We had places that were named after them, but we didn't have whole cults that sort of built up around them. I mean, a cult is built up around an individual, isn't it? And interesting here also that Bardney was in Viking territory, so there was this daring raid into the Viking territory in order to get the relics and save the relics. I mean, it was very important to them that they saved the relics. R.W. Morgan gives us some more details on this. He says Oswald's body was interred at Bardsey, which is the island off Anglesey, but his arms were deposited in silver shrines at Durham and Lindisfarne, and miracles attributed to them. This victory over Oswald, placed all Saxondom at the foot of the victor. Neither rival nor rebel disturbed the remainder of his reign, the security of which was further confirmed by a brief but sanguinary war which broke out between the two leading Saxon reguli, Pendar and Oswy, Oswald's son, and in which Pendar, with his principal officers, 30 in number, fell by their foolhardy contempt of their opponents. So they ended up misreading the situation, underestimating Oswy, who obviously had his father Oswald to avenge. And Edwin, at this point, I mean, he was ruling over the whole of the Saxon lands. He was the Pendragon, if you remember from last week, or Cadwallo rather was the Pendragon. And once he became king, it was one of these other kings that wanted the right to wear a crown, and he was told that he couldn't, and this started off all these battles. But he was actually the king over the whole of England. The last years of Cadwallo's reign were spent in London. He died in his 74th year, November 15th, 664. His body was embalmed and entombed in a sarcophagus in the front of St. Martin's Church, surmounted by a group cast in brass of himself, his armour bearer, and his steed. And they remained until it was destroyed by the Danes in AD 1018. So these Danes don't appear to be particularly respectful of Christianity. I mean, it goes in cycles, doesn't it? You have the Saxons come in and they're destroying things, and they're destroying the monastery at Bangor. And then you have the Danes coming in, and the Danes are destroying the monasteries that the Saxons have built and getting rid of all the scriptures and all the writings and all the histories that the Saxon monks have carefully written down after learning how to read and write. And then you've got the Danes come in again and destroy them all. Shufids, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, it just shows you how destructive, paganism is essentially. It's just law of the jungle, really, right? It's whoever's strongest might is right, that they make the laws and they can just do whatever they want, right? And that Christianity, it brings a lot more civilization, that people have this revelation that there are laws from God, and at least they're meant to, everyone's meant to be equal under God in that regards to the law. And life becomes a lot better. And then over the centuries, we've got to where we are now, where, you know, you can freely walk around and not be assaulted and harassed. And that's all centuries of Christianity, right? And most people today don't realize that. They think that Christianity is weak or something, and that we need to go back to paganism, and they don't realize what they really are asking for, right?
Yeah, they're just talking about sort of destroying things. I always liken it as, you know, you can't go back to being at junior school. And we were at junior school when we were pagans, and then we were at secondary school when we were Christians. And I guess now you've left school, basically. You can't go back to being a child again. You can't go back to being at junior school again. That's what people that are saying, oh, we should go back to paganism. That is effectively what they're saying, because we've grown on since then. As a people, we've grown on since then. And it's not like it was in those times when you just took what you wanted and there really wasn't very much law. We've had a big system of law that's been built up since then as well, a lot of which is derived from the Bible, particularly when we get to Alfred the Great. He makes a lot of mention of the biblical influence on Alfred's dooms, which were his laws. Patriarch, any thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, it's just that the Danes clearly came from offshore, right? Like you said earlier, they would have just still come from Denmark, and obviously the Saxons were originally Danes of Danish ancestry themselves. But yeah, I think anyone that really claims to want to go back to paganism is they reject Christianity. Just it's not necessarily they reject true Christianity, it's the Judeo-Christianity, and it's just they want to revert to the next sense of identity that they can kind of adopt. It's a sense of identity that people are longing for, and you know, the sooner they realize that our identity is actually in Christ, ancestry as well, then they won't pine for kind of, you know, crazy ideas of paganism.
Yeah, it's like throwing the baby out with the bathwater again, isn't it? I mean, the motive there is right. You know, you look around you and you think that everything isn't how it should be, and we're promoting evil instead of promoting good. And then they see the modern church or Judeo-Christianity, which is doing nothing about it, and then they associate that as being the source of the problem, when the church has become corrupted in the same way that every other one of our institutions is now corrupted. And you can't throw Christianity out. We're throwing out civilization. I mean, wanting to go back to paganism is effectively right. Well, we'll just get rid of all the civilization that was created once we became Christian, shall we? You know, as Truthers were pointing out, you know, you can walk along the street without being attacked. And that's all a part of this. And all of this being on good terms with our neighbours, that all comes from this Christian idea, and that we're all Christian as well. So if we move on to what Wikipedia has to say about Cadwallon ap Cadfan, that's Cadwallon, the son of Cadfan, died 634. He was the king of Gwynedd from around 625 until his death in battle. The son and successor of Cadfan ap Lego, he is best remembered as the king of the Britons, who invaded and conquered the kingdom of Northumbria, defeating and killing its king Edwin prior to his own death in battle against Oswald of Bernicia, and that's Oswy of Bernicia, the son of St. Oswald. His conquest of Northumbria, which he held for a year or two after Edwin died, made him one of the last recorded culturally traditional Celtic Britons to hold substantial territory in eastern Britain until the rise of the Welsh House of Tudor. He was thereafter remembered as a national hero by the Britons and as a tyrant by the Anglo-Saxons of Northumbria. So we sort of have a confirmation there from Wikipedia that he was the Bratwalder, he was the Pendragon, the king over the whole of Britain at that point, because he had effectively subdued all the Saxons in that area, in Northumbria. Truefids, any thoughts on Wikipedia's description here?
Yeah, you can see that back then everyone was very tribal. They weren't keen on one of the other tribes ruling over them as king. But by the time of, Henry the Fifth, the Tudors, and his Henry the Eighth and his father Henry the Seventh, we'd all kind of just become one race by then, Britons, and people didn't really care if it was a Welsh guy who was king. You know, he's just basically the king of Britain, and it didn't really matter what tribe he came from, because we all kind of saw ourselves as Britons, British by then, right?
Yeah, that's the point, isn't it? You know, because these people were all part of the same race, once they had been in Britain for a generation or two, they became indistinguishable from the Britons. You know, they're all speaking the same language, they've all got the same religion, Christianity. They don't look any different to one another. I mean, you do get slight differences. You know, the Scots look slightly different from the Welsh, look slightly different from the Irish. But I think unless you're actually from Great Britain, you don't really notice those differences. I mean, going abroad, the Lithuanians, they look slightly different, similar to the Latvians as well, again, but they're all still part of the same race. And I guess because of breeding preferences within one territory, you get certain aspects, certain features get repeated and you get more of them. And then that sort of defines that group as being separate to another group. But they're all part of the same race. And once we have people here for, well, as I say, one or two generations, they do become indistinguishable. So, you know, by the time you get to Alfred the Great's time, he's quite happy to go to the Welsh and ask them for an archbishop to come and teach his men how to read and write. You know, whereas that wouldn't have happened at this point in time, because the Welsh were like mortal enemies of the Saxons. And even the Welsh weren't united together. They weren't all together as one group. If you read in the history of the kings of Britain, it tells you that, that was the reason why they lost against the Saxons, is because they wouldn't unite together. They had all these separate kingdoms and they would fight amongst themselves. And that was really the reason why Edward I was able to wipe them out and take the monarchy away from them, because they wouldn't really unite. They were always fighting amongst ourselves, sadly. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
So was Cadwallon essentially sort of the last the last king that represented like a rightful heir to the throne then, with regard to tribalism?
Yeah, since, going back to Brutus.
Yeah. Okay, so he was the last one essentially then, and then from there on it was the kind of unity came about.
Yeah, he was the last one to rule over a sizable area, to sort of rule over Britain, and the next one that actually came from that direct bloodline were the Tudors, Henry of Tudor. So from this time on, the ones that are basically ruling are the Saxons. You still have descendants of Brutus that are ruling smaller areas, but they're not ruling the whole country anymore. You know, this was the last of the Pendragons was Cadwallo. This is what R.W. Morgan says. He says, Cadwallo Sanctus, the last Cymric monarch of Britain till Harry Tudor succeeded in AD 664. He is the Cadwallar of Bede and of the Saxon Chronicles. So you do get some confusion because you get people with the same name, basically. So Wikipedia are saying that this Cadwallo is the one that was the last king, whereas R.W. Morgan is saying it's actually his son, Cadwallo Sanctus, was the last Cymric monarch of Britain. This is the Cadwallo of Bede and the Saxon Chronicle. Kent, rebelling and killing his brother Mull of the Saxon Chronicle, he punished it with great severity, finding it impossible to unite under one sceptre his father's subjects, the Cymry, and his mother's, the Gwisei, or West Saxons and Mercians. He appears at an early period to have meditated retiring from the cares of royalty to a religious life. This determination was hastened by one of those visitations of the Almighty, which more than all human revolutions or devices have so often changed the destinies of nations. The Black Plague, called by the British writers the Vengeance of God, Dial Diu, broke out AD 670 and raged for 12 years. So I.W. Morgan is saying this was the last Cymric monarch of Britain, but he wasn't actually ruling Britain. Cadwallo was the last one that was to actually rule as a Pendragon. This was his son, Cadwallo Sanctus, but he didn't actually rule over Britain. Although he was the rightful monarch, he didn't actually rule over anyone. So that explains the difference between what R.W. Morgan is saying and what Wikipedia is saying. Interesting that you have this Black Plague that bursts out and changes everything. Famine, as usual, accompanied its progress. The mortality was such that whole counties were left without an inhabitant, such of the population as were spared by the epidemic, falling victims to the famine or despair. Companies of men and women, states Henry of Huntingdon, 50 and 60 in number, crawled to the cliffs and there, joining hands, precipitated themselves in a body into the sea. The birds also perished in countless numbers, and all distinction between Briton and Saxon was lost in this appalling state of affairs. So that could have been what really melded the Britons and the Saxons together. The fact that instead of having to fight against one another, they were having to fight against the plague, and they had no medical means of actually stopping this plague. And because so many of them died because of the plague, they weren't able to do the planting. They weren't able to harvest, so they had famine. So they were starving and committing suicide, masses of them committing suicide. Very sad state of affairs. Truefids, any thoughts?
Yeah, I was just going to say that when the people aren't united of a nation, this always happens, right? Someone stronger will just come over and rule over you. The same thing happens later when Edward the Confessor dies and there's no kind of heir. And then Harold, he was, I believe, like a lord or a duke or something. And he just said, well, I'll be king. Allegedly, it was led by Edward. That's what he said. And the other like powerful people weren't too happy about that. And you get all this infighting. And then William just comes over and takes it all, you know. So the same thing happened later to the Anglo-Saxons. That's what always happens when you start arguing and bickering with each other. You have to be united. That's a lesson we can learn. And it's happened many times in history. And it's also interesting that the West Saxons were originally called the Gowis, right? Because that seems to have been like a mercenary group or something. So perhaps that's, again, evidence that these Saxons originally were, mercenaries brought over. We went over that, right? And I believe also the first, the origin of the Saxon kings, I'm going to say Cerdic, and you're going to correct me, right, and say it's Cerdic. But that's actually a British name, right? So it shows you that they were even intermarrying by then. And here again, we see that the British kings, they had intermarried, right? His mother was of the West Saxons as well. So already you can see they're all intermarried already, right?
Yeah, I think that started with Vortigern, wasn't it? Vortigern married the daughter of Hengist. And although Vortigern was a tyrant, he was the one that brought the Saxons over. He was a Briton and he married a Saxon daughter. So straight away, you had this intermarrying between the two royal families, exactly the same as you had the intermarrying between the Roman senators and, again, the British royal family. And that's what gave these Romans the right to claim that they could lead all of Rome, was the fact that, that they were married into a British royal family. Because I think the Romans got rid of their own royal family, and they were descended from the same family that Brutus was descended from. I mean, we talked about it, I think, an episode or two back when we were talking about the origins of the Pope, and how that went back to Aeneas, who was the grandfather of Brutus. And I think the Romans killed off their royal family, but the royal family going back to Aeneas through Brutus was still going in Britain. So they could end up marrying them, and then they would have the right to rule. And we see the same thing here. We in the last episode, we had the king, I think it was Edwin, that was asking the British king whether he could also wear a crown, whether he could wear the diadem Britannia. And he was told no, only one king in Britain, that's the usage, only one king can actually wear this crown. All the others had, I think, a coronet or some other type of signifier that they were lower than the main king. But yeah, they were all sort of intermarried together and became the same. Because, you know, this sort of thing is what our politicians will refer to when they talk about immigration and saying, oh, well, it's fine, you know, these groups can come over here and then they just become like the same as the Britons. But the difference is the people that are coming over here now are a completely different race. You know, that was the difference. When the Saxons came over, when the Danes came over, when William the Conqueror came over, they were all part of the same extended family. So when they married in and they became assimilated, what we've got now with immigration is groups from another family, a completely different family, not part of our extended family. And what happens is they just end up replacing the family that is here. You know, people with a completely different culture, different way of doing things, people that have a completely different biology to the groups that are here. So it's not the same thing. And this is the problem, because we have a wonderful history of accepting other Europeans into our country and accepting them as refugees in some instances, and helping them and them becoming the same as us and them assimilating. But you can't do that with people from other races. I mean, that's what history tells us. When you do that with people of other races, then the people that maintain that civilization and built it are no longer the same people anymore, because they've intermingled with another race and the civilization falls. And that's what history tells us. So I've gone a little bit off topic there, but I'm sure Patriarch will have something to say about it. Patriarch, any views?
Well, a couple of things on the points you just made. I mean, that's clearly the intention, though, of those that are in control now, is to subvert the native race to become a rootless people, to sever us at the roots, and to create a new people. I call it the people of the new children of the new world, essentially, because it's a people that are bred specifically for a new world order to come, you know, which the roots and the nature, the native peoples, they're not interested in retaining that. On another note, back to the initial points, it's amazing to see God's hand in all of this, really, through a sort of a natural disaster and famine. It kind of became the ultimate glue, didn't it? You know, I find that quite interesting. And, you know, despite all the brother wars and kind of trying to rule through force and by the sword, you know, it takes some kind of natural disaster or a sort of an outside threat almost to actually bind them. So, you know, hopefully in some ways we can kind of take comfort in that and acknowledge the outside threat that we've got going on now, and then, you know, hopefully band together all peoples from all kindred peoples from the left and the right.
Yeah, that's what we learn from history and from looking at this, isn't it? Once there's an outside threat that comes that is greater than the threat posed between these two groups, and then the two groups end up uniting to try and counter this other threat. And yeah, that is very similar to what is happening today. I mean, if you look 100 years ago, the nationalism was petty nationalism, and it was the English against the Germans and the Germans against the French. Whereas now, though, you know, we haven't got the luxury of maintaining those distinctions, because we're all facing this demographic replacement. All the European families and tribes are facing the same existential threat, basically, with this displacement that is being carried out by our own people. I mean, I have to point that out. It's maladaptive behavior. It's suicidal behavior in our leaders. But what has happened because of that is that you now have a much more sense of being brother nations, whereas before, you know, as I point out, there was this animosity between the English and the Germans, whereas between nationalists now, it's a sense of, look, we're all facing this demographic replacement and we all need to be helping one another out. So this greater threat encourages this bonding between the groups and this realization that we're all part of the same extended family. And we've got to protect ourselves from being displaced by these other families in the world. Getting back to R.W. Morgan here, Cadwallo abdicated his throne, and retiring to Rome, he died there. So he left the country because the situation was so dire. He was interred at St. Peter's, 18th of May, 689. From this date to AD 720 follows a period of confusion and impenetrable obscurity. In the north, the Britons of Strathclyde in AD 684 had annihilated the army of Egfrid, king of Northumbria, at Drumnechtar in Porthshire. Egfrid himself, Bjort, his general, and 50,000 Angles falling on the field. No attempt, states Bede, writing in AD 729, has since been made on the liberties of the Britons. The Picts have recovered all their territories, and the power of the Angles has continued to retrograde. So essentially by this time you had the Britons in Wales and Cambria, and then you had the Picts up in Scotland, and you had the Angles, the Saxons and the Jutes, who were starting to form their own identity by this time as the English. And you haven't really got these battles that were going on apart from just in this one area here in Northumbria. If we move on up to Scotland, the three kingdoms of the Strathclyde Britons, the British Picts and the Scots of Ireland, finally united and became known as the Kingdom of Scotland. The Highlands remained as before, occupied by the primitive British clans of Albion, and were not incorporated under one government with the rest of the island until AD 1745. In the south, Idwal Eirik, the son of Cadwalder, with Ivor, the second son of Alan II of Brittany, and Enir, his nephew, landed on the cessation of the pestilence to recover his hereditary dominions. So it does look as if a lot of people actually left Britain at this point. A lot of the royalty left Britain and then came back to with their right to rule, basically. So that's what you've got going on in Scotland there. And you've got the Scots that are uniting. Idwal was crowned Prince of Cambria at Carnarvon, that's in North Wales. Ivor was received by Curno, Somerset, Devon and Cornwall, and in the course of 6 years established himself firmly on the West Saxon throne. Idwal, abdicating his claim in right of his grandmother, the sister of Pendar, in his favour. Ivor's marriage with Ethelberga, cousin of Kentuin, consolidated his power, and on Kentuin's demise, he added Kent and Mercia to his dominions. The Saxons, rebelling under Kenwulf, the Etheling, were again subdued, AD 721, and Ealdbert, the Etheling of South Saxony, was slain by him, and South Saxony annexed in AD 725. So I think we can really sort of sum that up as in you had some Saxon kings, Ivor, and you also had some Brittonic kings, Enir and Idwal, and they were working together, basically, and they had their separate areas, and they were intermarrying here. Like, you've got Ivor's marriage with Ethelberga, cousin of Kentuin. We've got Pendar that's still being mentioned here, who was the Saxon king, the pagan Saxon king, that was also allied with Cadwallo, the Briton king. And that's really what you've got going on there. Henceforth, the fusion of the Briton and Saxon dynasties and populations in southern England may be regarded as complete. Devon, however, and Cornwall remained nearly purely British for some centuries longer, and the curtain of history falls at this time, AD 730, with the Night of the Dark Ages upon Britain. And of course, this is a Welsh author. So what he refers to as the Night of the Dark Ages upon Britain, in about, I guess, 100 years from then, became the Golden Age for the Saxons under King Alfred the Great. And we'll get into that in a later episode, I'm sure. Treefitz, any thoughts on all of this? We've covered quite a bit here with the Picts in Scotland and the Britons and the Saxon kings coming back after the famine.
Yeah, whenever, you know, there's a massive migration, you always get a period of, you know, quote unquote, dark ages where it takes a while for civilization to restart, you know, for people to resettle. But then you get this, you know, it comes back very quickly as long as it's white populations, right? And often it goes up even to greater heights, right? Because the population's bigger and, you know, it just keeps getting better and better. But interestingly, back to Scotland, if you look at the Declaration of Arbroath, they identified as Scots, right? And they fought in the Declaration of Arbroath, they say they wiped out the Picts, but it's much more likely that they actually just blended together. And that because the king would identify as Scottish, they just called themselves the Scots from then on, right? But really, they're just a blend of these three nations. It's interesting that the British held out, you know, the native Britons until 1745. I believe that was when, the British Empire was starting to really expand, and they went up and they wiped out all these old clans, right? Because they were fed up and you know, Britain just wanted, it was becoming very tyrannical then in the British Empire, and they just wiped out these clans once and for all, right? And brought them under the hill. Am I right there, Sven?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about that. Yeah, the Highland clearances, wasn't it? It was the Highland clearances when we went up there, and they basically took the people that were up there, and I think they sent them off as slaves to America. And they did the same thing in Ireland. And anyone that was a former peasant ran the risk of being kidnapped, basically, and sent off to America as an indentured servant. And I think the way the government looked at it at the time was that, well, these people aren't actually doing anything here. If we send them off to America, that land needs taming, and that gives them a chance to establish themselves and make something for themselves, whereas they can't do that here in England, Scotland and Wales, because this land is owned by the lords, and we want it as farmland. We don't want these people that are living on there. They're just subsisting off the land. They're not contributing, and they would have a better chance of making something of themselves if we sent them to America. I mean, that was their sort of logic, but the way that played out was that we had the Highland clearances, we had the same in Ireland. You had this, you know, this fear of getting kidnapped by a ship, basically. I think they would buy you a drink, and they would drop a penny in the drink or something like that. And then if you had your drink, that was accepting the penny, and you'd get put on the ship and you'd get taken, well, you just get kidnapped then and put on the ship and taken off to America, where you'd be in indentured servitude for 8 years. It was supposed to be 8 years, and at the end of that term, you were supposed to be released. But in some cases, they would just think up some spurious breaking of the rules that the person had done, and they would be in indentured servitude for another 8 years. And indentured servitude just meant as a slave. And you can read all the information on this in Michael Hoffman's They Were White and They Were Slaves. He goes into a lot of details on this. So, yeah, I think that is what R.W. Morgan is referring to here when he says that they held out up there in Scotland until 1745. The primitive British clans of Albion, which is also where we get the name Albania from, Albin, were not, and Alban, it's still called Alban today, isn't it, up there in Scotland, they were not incorporated under one government with the rest of the island until A.D. 1745. So, yeah, I think that was the Highland clearances there. Any thoughts on that, Patriarch, or any of the rest that we've been going into there?
I guess they just thought, you know, they'll pit savage against savage. If they were sort of primitive, then they probably thought they'll put them to good use against primitive tribe, you know, indigenous? Can you say indigenous tribes of America, or the ones that were predominantly there before the Europeans went over? So they probably just thought they'd be better suited to put to use.
Yeah, that's really well picked up on them there as well, isn't it? Primitive. I mean, that shows you that R.W. Morgan, he was sort of still understanding it from the side of you know, the landed gentry in England and Wales, and seeing the people that lived up there as rather primitive. So he's sort of excusing basically what went on with these Highland clearances. I mean, we can look back at that now and we can say, oh, that was a terrible thing to do. But you can see here that the way that they were looking at it is, well, these were primitive people, and they were being sent off to somewhere where they were far more suited and where they could actually serve the cause of advancing civilization in this other land. You know, we have to always, I think, be careful not to project today's sensibilities on the people of the past and what their actions were, you know, because you tend to look at that and say, well, how evil, you know, getting rid of all those people and getting rid of those Irish and getting rid of the Highland clearances and clearing it all. But it wasn't that they were, you know, trying to be wicked people. They were, you know, the motive behind it was, here's a way that they can help the general good of all of us, and they got a chance to make something for themselves, and they did make something for themselves, didn't they? I mean, if you look at Americans and the people that go back to that time, you know, all in the southern states, in Kentucky and Tennessee and places like that, you know, they've all done very well for themselves. You know, the ones that say, you know, well, I come from Scottish heritage or I come from Irish heritage, that's the heritage that they're talking about, getting kidnapped and sent off to America as a slave. You know, they've all done rather well for themselves, I would say.
It'd be worth noting also what Truth Fitz touched on just before about the Declaration of Arbroath. If people should read that, because it gives a greater insight into how they perceived their own ancestry, from the Scythians to going back to Israelites, really.
Yeah, it mentions it in the Declaration of Arbroath, doesn't it? That the Scots themselves go back to being Scythians, and before that they were Israelites, and that's referring to the removal of the 10 tribes of Israel and then putting them up above Assyria, and then they work their way into Europe from that place where they were up above Assyria. And we've gone into it, and they were recorded as being the Scythians. They were also recorded as being the Gomri, coming from King Omri. So one language has them as the Gomri, which becomes the Cimmerians. Another language has them as the Scythians, which becomes the Saxons. And then you end up with the Cimmerians are the Cymry, are the Welsh, and the Scythians have become the Saxons. And of course, the Saxons and the Welsh are fighting against one another. But what the origin story tells us is they were originally the same group. They were originally the one group that was the 10 tribes of Israel that were put up in that area in captivity up above Assyria. And then they made their way into Europe. I mean, the evidence for that is the big stone carving, the Behistun rock, which people can look up on Wikipedia, this Behistun rock. Although obviously on Wikipedia, it doesn't tell you these bits that I'm talking about here, because they try to cover that up. But that is the correct interpretation, because they also found all the tablets in the library at Nineveh, which had records of these spies that were sent out by the king. And these spies were reporting on these Gomri, this Gomera, these people that were the tribes of Israel. And that's the word that they use for them, Gomri, coming from King Omri. That's where this word Cymry comes from, is King Omri, this Israelite king. So it's referring to the same people, and the Scythians were the same people. I forget what it was. So Gomri was the word in Assyrian, and Scusa or Scythian must have been the word in Akkadian, I think. And then there was another language, and the word was Habiru as well. So you got those three words telling you what the name of these people that were in that area. And I think then you've got 10 supplicants making their gifts to the king, and they're all much smaller, and obviously the king's bigger. And that seems to refer to the fact that there were 10 tribes there as well. And you've got this writing, which is in three different languages, which is telling you what's going on. And then obviously you have the Latin and the Greek writers, and they're writing about these people in their histories and in their geographies as they make their way into Europe. And they write about the Cimmerians, and then they write about the Scythians. And then we hear in the British histories, when they're referring to Germany, they're referring to Scythia, because they knew that it was the Scythians that had made their way into Germany. So that's another interesting one, isn't it? You've got you've got the Scots saying their ancestry goes back to the Scythians. And then a little bit before that, you've got the British historians saying that the Germans come from the Scythians. So this all ties in that we're all part of the same extended family. And that's why after these brief skirmishes, we sort of meld together. We're able to meld together as one people. And that's the origins of the British people today.
Yeah, and even in scripture, you have three distinct categories as well referenced. Jew, or as depicted as Judean, Judahite, Greek, which were essentially Hellenized offspring of Israel. And then it says Scythian. So, you know, even in scripture, it depicts the three groups quite specifically. And we understand them now as a larger extended family.
Yeah, Judahite, Grecian, and Scythian. Truthvids, any final thoughts on this today before we finish?
Yeah, I was just going to say that that the reason that it's kind of Gimri or Kimri is because in the ancient languages, the C and the G kind of overlap the K and the G, kind of like how if in some European languages, the V and the W overlap, like we'll say V, like Volkswagen, they'll say Volkswagen rather than Wagen, you know, in Germany. And if you say vodka, a Pole will say vodka. Well, back then, you know, in the Assyrian times, the C and the G overlap. So where we would where the Israelites would say Kimri, they might say Gimri, and it might have even had a guttural sound like Himri. So that's why there's a little bit of confusion with Gimri, Kimri. And on that tablet you mentioned, they also showed the Israelites with the long hats. And when the Scythians or Sakai are described, they're also horse archers with the long hats. So you can see that the culture continued, that our people continued to have those long hats for whatever reason. And they were the horse archers, right, that came over. And that's, you also ended up with the Parthian Empire over there as well. So I just wanted to add that in.
Were they the same hats as the Liberty hats, the origin of that, you know, the sort of cap for liberty that they had in the French Revolution, do you know? Like a Smurf hat?
I'm not sure. No idea with that one.
Yeah, this is an old type of hat that goes all the way back. Patriarch, any final thoughts on this today?
Well, I just think it's, I mean, how everything came about, it's often done on, you know, through bloodshed. Yeah, I mean, it's just interesting history, isn't it? It's our history. And I think, you know, the points made about the different groups of people, we do have to make a distinction of them being kindred, and we can't really assume that to be, you know, the same thing that's happening today in our lands with completely foreign peoples.
Yeah, that's the point, isn't it? That's why they're able to assimilate, is because they were kindred peoples. But the people that we've got coming over here now are from completely different people groups with completely different origins. Whereas what we learn by looking at the British history is that the origins of the British people were originally shared, because they were originally the same people. You know, the Britons and the Romans went back to the Trojans. The Trojans went back to the sons of Judah, and who was an Israelite. And then you've got the 10 tribes of Israel that ended up being the Scythians, the Saxons, and the Cimmerians. So they all originally go back to being the same people. So they're able to assimilate and become melded together as one people. But with these other groups that you've got coming over now, they have completely different origins, totally different origins to white people. I mean, that's why they're non-white people, because they come from a different family.
Yeah, and to add to that, I mean, that's essentially what's happened throughout Europe and in the migrations and Britain, that essentially was prophetic, wasn't it? To essentially band together both the house of Israel and the house of Judah into one flock. And that's exactly what happened to build up Christendom, you know, and essentially bring about the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah, and now you got to the bit where the camp of the saints is surrounded. That's all rather prophetical rather than historical, I think. So we'll just leave that there then. And in the next episode, we'll take a look at the Saxon era, and we'll also take a look at Charles Martel, I think. So thank you very much for coming on today, Truthfits.
Thank you for having me, as always, Sven.
Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thanks a lot, Sven. Thanks for the great information.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.